Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are known today as the Stockbridge Munsee community. I'm Kalen McPherson.
And I'm David Moore. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine First, state lawmakers joined 100 advocates at the New York State Capitol to demand that the New York State Legislature pass the NY Heat Act before the end of session. Mark Dunley shares audio from various advocates from the rally. Then, Moses Nagel speaks with Terry Diggory of the Saratoga Immigration Coalition about some more compassionate ways to conceive the recent influx of asylum seekers. Later on, we talk with Pete Tredish, a technician for community radio stations. After that, we hear from the master gardeners at the Cornell Cooperative Extension of Greene and Columbia Counties about all things asparagus, my time of year. Finally, This week's Talking with Poets is a replay of Tom France's conversation with Mary Panza and her poem, We're Barefoot People. But first, here are the headlines.
Schenectady police are investigating the city's first homicide of the year after finding a woman dead from a gunshot wound Monday morning inside a residence in Mount Pleasant District. Two Saratoga County Sheriff's deputies were shot and wounded after someone opened fire as authorities executed a federal drug search warrant at a home in Clifton Park early Tuesday morning. One suspect was also shot.
The state's mid-level courts have upheld a lower court's dismissal of a suit seeking to annul parts of New York's three-year-old fast-track system for approving large new solar farms. The Shepherd's Run solar farm, being constructed in Columbia County, was central to the case. Some area residents have contended that the solar panels will detract from the region's rural setting and hurt tourism in the process.
The New York State Thruway Authority wants 5% increase in toll prices in 2024 and 2027 for EZ Pass holders. The price increase will be larger for those who pay tolls via the mail.
The latest round of the Regional Economic Development Council initiative is accepting applications, allowing each region in the state to compete for state funding for local projects that aim to improve their communities and create economic growth. The application period ends July 28.
The Times Union reports that the business community has begun to mobilize to oppose a pending New York State bill to force private hedge funds to comply with debt relief deals that the U.S. government brokers with cash-strapped foreign countries. The bill is important since many of the foreign debt financial government agreements are made in New York. The bill drafted by Jubilee USA caps the amount that the private creditors can recover from a debt-distressed country to the same amount that the U.S. government is willing to recoup. Many of the firms known as vulture funds buy up such debt agreements after the country announces it can no longer meet the original payback term.
That's it for the headlines.
And for those just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, listener-supported radio that builds community in Troy and the surrounding capital region through broad grassroots participation.
Our content is produced by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
State lawmakers join 100 advocates at the New York State Capitol to demand that the New York State Legislature pass the New York Heat Act before the end of session. We hear first from New Yorkers from the Clean Power New York Heat Act. We Act for Environmental Justice, Alicia Bacon of Mothers Out Front, Albany County Legislator, and from SHARE, Mark Dunley reports.
At the New York State Capitol on Tuesday, to demand that the legislature pass the New York Heat Act. The critical climate bill would cap energy bills at 6% of household income for low and middle income families, saving them up to $75 per month. New York Heat also gets rid of the unfair 100-foot rule, which forces New York families to subsidize new gas hookups to the tune of $200 million every year and worsens the climate crisis. We hear first from Better Broad, the MC, who is the campaign director for New Yorkers for Clean Power, followed by Senator Liz Krueger, the lead sponsor of the New York Heat Act. Also speaking are Sonal Jessel, policy director for We Act for Environmental Justice, Elisha Bacon of Mothers Out Front, and Albany County Legislator and Share co-chair Merton Simpson.
Allies in the legislature who are working with us to make energy affordable for all New York families. Because the fact is, even though leadership says they're worried about affordability, the budget didn't do enough to relieve sky-high energy costs for the most impacted families. They have the chance to help save the planet and make it so New Yorkers aren't forced to choose between keeping cool and keeping food on the table. Right now, low-income families spend 3 times more on energy bills than other families, and that's not right. New York Heat will fix that. Cap utility bills at 6% of income for low and moderate income families. That means low income families can save up to $75 a month. More money for food, for rent, for medicine, and other basic necessities. Because the fact is, our existing gas system is incredibly expensive for everyone. Because of the 100-foot rule, New Yorkers are paying $200 million every year to expand outdated gas infrastructure to new customers who get their new pipes for free, and we're paying for it. It's not right, but New York Heat will stop that giveaway, and it will redirect the planned $150 billion in costs for new pipes toward climate-friendly solutions instead. Those gas pipe replacements will become obsolete before we're even done paying for them, and that's crazy. And we're not just saying that. Even National Grid is trying to sell off their fossil gas utility system in the Northeast because even they know that gas is on the way out. And on top of that, New York Heat will also get rid of the obligation to serve, which means gas utilities will no longer have an excuse to build this gas infrastructure that we don't need anymore. New York Heat is the clear answer to our affordability problem, and 52 Assembly co-sponsors would agree. Now we need the Senate to pass New York Heat and Assembly Member Zebrowski to bring New York Heat to a committee vote and move it to the floor. We can't wait another year. The legislature must pass New York Heat now. Thank you. And now we're going to hear from our legislative leaders, starting with our incredible champion, Senate Liz Krueger.
I think our hostess already explained exactly why this bill is so important, but I'll just ask again. Anybody want to save ratepayers $200 million a year? And as Sherry also pointed out, the entire system of gas infrastructure is old, and the repairs are costing us hundreds of millions of dollars more. Why? We're not even supposed to be using gas. We all know that. We know we need to get off of gas. We know we have passed the CLCPA that has told us exactly why and when and how. So why the hell would we continue spending ratepayers' money at the tune of at least $200 million a year to continue to expand gas pipes? Does that make any sense?
No!
Your Heat bill, as was said, will cap expenses on utilities for low and moderate New Yorkers to 6% of their income per year. That is huge. It will stop the continued building of gas pipelines to that last 100-foot rule that was already described to you. That totally makes no sense in today's world. I'm committed to get this through the Senate.
My name is Sonal Jessel. I'm the Director of Policy at We Act for Environmental Justice. We are a community-based organization and representing Harlem, Washington Heights, and Inwood in New York City. So the budget didn't do nearly enough for low and middle income families who face the highest energy burden, and a hot summer ahead along with even higher bills are coming. New York Heat, like we said, can save somewhere around $75 a month for people. That's money for groceries, rent, medicine, and anything. It's low and middle income households are the most impacted by volatile gas prices, high energy bills. They pay more than three times more of their income on energy bills than non-low income households. Low income residents in New York City spend a median of 9.3% of their household income on their energy bills. New York Heat Act would cap bills at 6% of household income for these families. This is also a matter of racial justice. University of California, Berkeley found that Black renters paid $273 more per year for energy than white renters. Black homeowners also paid $408 more for energy than white homeowners during the same period. We are facing rising rates both in New York City. New York Heat will also help us secure some level of financial safety for our residents as we're transitioning away from fossil fuels. So we encourage our legislature to pass New York Heat.
Next is Elisha Bacon of Mothers Out Front.
New York has an urgent need for implementation of the New York Home Energy Affordability and Transparency Act. This critical legislation aims to make New York a great place for all to live. Right now, there is a disproportionate burden of high utility bills on lower income households. Many currently allocate a staggering 10% of their income to meet their energy needs. The New York Heat Act seeks to alleviate this financial strain by reducing utility bills by roughly $75 per month for those who struggle to most make the ends meet. This would mean that households and families here in Albany would see their energy costs go down now, which is vital as nearly a quarter of the city here lives below the outdated poverty line. The New York Heat Act will provide immediate relief to vulnerable New Yorkers, and this is a critical part of the Climate Jobs and Justice Package. This comprehensive suite of legislation is designed to build an inclusive and environmentally conscious society where every resident has the opportunity to not just survive, but to truly thrive. Nobody should have to choose between keeping cool or keeping food on the table.
The last speaker we hear from is Albany County Legislator and Share Co-Chair Merton Simpson. Mert focused on the push to convert the state capitol complex to 100% renewable energy, which would allow the state to finally shut down the power plant on Sheridan Avenue, which has polluted the low-income neighborhood of color for more than a century.
The New York Heat Act, and we need to pass this before the legislators go home. But I'm here today to talk about another related bill that Senator Breslin and Assemblywoman Fahey, Renewable Capital Act. Basically, what we're asking for is to have the Capitol, the Empire State Plaza, the museum, the Education Building, the Alfred E. Smith Building, is a 98.5-acre facility. The city of Albany has approximately 100,000 people. On any given day, the workforce in the Empire State Plaza is 11,000 people, not including guests, lobbyists, visitors. The Empire State Plaza, the Capitol, at a time when we have the CLCPA, and to have frack gas pumped in from Pennsylvania is like preaching in our underwear. But we need to call on Governor Hochul to do the right thing. All these lofty goals we have for renewable energy is meaningless if we don't even have our own house in order. The Empire State Plaza historically has been a model innovation, and we have a responsibility to lead. What we're talking about is global sustainability. Right now, they're excited in England because they can grow champagne grapes. But the last time I checked, more people eat potatoes than drink champagne. And the climate is not compatible for both things. We have to have our priorities straight. I am afraid that even if we were doing everything possible now, our grandchildren wouldn't have a future much better than The Walking Dead. But we're so far from doing everything possible that I shudder to think how close we are, or if we already passed the tipping point.
This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
One of the missions of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is to cover stories of social and environmental justice, just like this one on the New York Heat Act. Keep listening to this station or go to mediasanctuary.org for further developments.
Saratoga and Rensselaer counties both declared a state of emergency last week in response to an expected influx of asylum seekers after New York City announced plans to begin busing migrants upstate. Rumors and fear-mongering have been rampant. Terry DiGiore of the Saratoga Immigrant Coalition spoke with Moses Nagel about some of the more compassionate ways to conceive of the recent developments.
It's a situation that's been growing for some months now, with New York City receiving large numbers of migrants from various sources. In some cases, Republican governors of southwest border states have been sending buses of migrants from the border to New York City as a challenge and punishment, in a sense. They say, you claim you're a sanctuary city, see what you can do with this number of people. And also, border cities have been sending migrants to their desired destination. So in some cases, it's not seen as a punishment, but it's just a matter of distributing people who have come into the country into whatever area of the country they want to get to because they have relatives or because they think they have a prospect of a job. So it's been building over some time, and New York City has felt that it's running out of space for offering housing for the folks who are coming in. Plus, the expiration of the Title 42 public health rule at the border on May 11th led to the expectation, although it's not an expectation that has been really fully realized, that there would be a large influx of people crossing the border at that time. So I think the New York City mayor was concerned both about the situation that was present, but also an expectation that things would be getting even worse. So he felt the need to act as soon as possible, and he began sending busloads of folks into upstate counties to find shelter there.
I feel like it's a little hard to get a real grasp on how much of this is a real crisis and how much of this is a manufactured panic. This has been a big story about the downstate officials that kind of created a fake situation with the military veterans being evicted in favor of immigrants. So how do you see government and the public in general reacting to this as it happens?
Yeah, I think you're right that it's manufactured artificial panic at a lot of levels. I mean, starting with all of the crisis rhetoric that surrounded the expiration of Title 42. Everybody said there's going to be this huge wave of people crossing the border. And as I said, that's proven not to be the case. New York City, I think, has faced a real challenge with housing folks, but the mayor's office has been, I think, artificially upping the rhetoric of crisis as an excuse for shipping some of the migrants out. And then certainly many of the upstate politicians have created a sense of emergency, a sense of crisis for political benefit. It's a Republican-Democrat division. It's an upstate-downstate division, which, of course, is a longstanding problem in New York State. But in reality, it's not a crisis. It's a perhaps scaling up of a situation that's been ongoing for a long time. I mean, upstate counties have been receiving migrants, you know, forever. In fact, the receiving of migrants has been an important part of the economy.
Can you explain to me some of these resolutions that I think Saratoga County is included in that are saying they're not going to allow any of these migrants to come?
Yeah, I know that many upstate counties are doing this. The only one that I'm directly familiar with, the only executive order that I've actually looked at, is the Saratoga County order, which was issued last Friday. It's actually two separate statements. One is an emergency declaration giving the county emergency powers and technically making the county eligible for emergency funding from the state and the federal government. And then the second is an emergency order. And that emergency order, in the case of Saratoga County, says that people may not transport migrants
into the county or within the county, and it says that people may not offer accommodation to migrants within the county. One big problem with that order, at least the way it's phrased in Saratoga County, is that there's no definition of the term migrant. So, for instance, there's a big concern in the city of Saratoga Springs right now about how such an order, if it were to continue, would affect the backstretch workers coming in for Saratoga Racecourse, because technically they are migrants. Obviously, that's not what the county intended to affect, but the fact that the order is so broad really, I think, makes it unworkable and, in fact, a major civil rights violation.
Wow, yeah, Saratoga has a huge yearly influx of migrants every summer, yeah. Right?
Right.
Who passes this executive order? Who does that come from?
The County Board of Supervisors, and the executive order is actually signed by the chairman of the Board of Supervisors. The chair of the Board of Supervisors moved ahead with this particular action on Friday without even consulting all of the supervisors. I know that, for instance, one of the supervisors representing the city of Saratoga Springs, Tara Gaston, objected that she was not consulted before the order was issued.
So what are some solutions that don't involve these kind of blanket bans and violations of civil rights and denying the general humanity of the people involved? What would be better?
Well, the solution is coordination and cooperation among the various levels of government, federal, state, and local, and between government entities and local community-based organizations, many of whom have been working with assistance to migrants for a long time and are prepared to offer further assistance. One example that we might be able to recall within recent history is that the city of Albany received an influx of Afghan refugees 2 years ago after the evacuation from Afghanistan with the takeover by the Taliban. And that was a challenge to the city of Albany and the larger capital district, but people met that challenge with the assistance of refugee resettlement agencies like USCRI and, again, the cooperation of the city, the county, and even state agencies helping out with finding facilities and making sure that services would be provided to the folks coming in. One of the differences between refugees coming in from Afghanistan and the folks that are currently coming up from New York City, who are for the most part asylum seekers, is that asylum seekers don't automatically qualify for the same kind of benefits that refugees do. So a major need that both the mayor of New York City and the governor of New York State are now pushing for from the federal government is adjustment in the waiting period for receiving work authorization. Right now, people who are asylum seekers have to wait at least 6 months after filing for asylum before they receive employment authorization. And obviously that means that they are necessarily going to be relying on public services during that waiting period. But these are people who want to work, and the quicker they can be authorized for employment, the quicker they'll find jobs and be able to find their own housing and support themselves.
Isn't Governor Hochul actually asking for some changes to that?
Yes. The mayor and the governor had a press conference yesterday morning in which they were appealing directly to the federal government for an adjustment in that regulation about employment authorization.
Is there anything that we missed that you want to add, or any recommendations for people hearing this who are sympathetic and want to do something to help?
Well, I guess I would just go back to what we were saying about the artificial sense of crisis here and hope that we can turn the narrative around to the positive side. And instead of saying, how can we handle an emergency, how can we be a welcoming community at every level? And I know that there are volunteers out there who would like to help. They can get in touch with the Saratoga Immigration Coalition, with the Troy Sanctuary Movement, with Capital District Border Watch in Albany. There are many volunteer organizations that are standing by ready to help, and faith communities are also, I think, eager to offer whatever support they can. So whatever network people are a part of, if they plug into that network and say, you know, I'm ready to help, then we'll all be in a better position to offer that cooperation I was talking about earlier.
For more coverage of those responses to those seeking asylum, continue to listen to Hudson Mohawk Magazine or go to mediasanctuary.org.
And for those just tuning in, I'm Galen McPherson.
And I'm David Moore. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio on WOOC LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOG LP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, and WOOA LP 106.9 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by telling a friend, stranger, neighbor, whoever. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org. Moving right along to our third segment, Petri Dish was a member of the founding collaborative of Radio Mutiny, 91.3 FM in Philadelphia, and the founder of the Prometheus Radio Project. Petri Dish goes around the community helping community radio stations like Hudson Mohawk Magazine with engineering need to get on the air. We welcome Petri Dish to talk about his work and helping other community radio stations.
So great to be here. Thanks a lot for having me.
So what do you... So I guess to start, tell us a little bit about yourself and what do you do at these radio stations when you go to help them out?
Well, you know, one thing about radio is that unlike the internet, it involves antennas and towers and lots of wires and cables and things, and they take some maintenance. Now, not that the internet doesn't have all those things, but those things are kind of made invisible to us and they're sort of behind the ownership of, you know, the big platforms and whatever. But, you know, when I was starting getting involved in this, there was a real important thing that we thought as people involved in making media was that ownership of the platform was very important, that you didn't want anyone to get between, you know, the community media organization and the listener and the people that were trying to, you know, to listen to it. You know, and that's a real different thing than, say, something like Facebook, where you write a post, it goes into a mysterious black box, maybe it comes in, maybe it doesn't. Maybe 100 of your friends see it, maybe 3 of them see it. No one knows. It all just, whatever's best for Facebook's advertising is what comes out of it. With community radio, you know, your voice goes straight into the transmitter and it goes out over the airwaves and then people pick it up and nobody can get in the way of that unless someone turns the radio off.
Or there's a glitch in the system, which is what you do.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's my job to sort of figure out, like, you know, right now we're trying to figure out, sometimes y'all are having some silences when the computer kicks off, or, there's a transmitter out there that's part of Hudson Mohawk Radio that's up in a tree. So sometimes a branch falls on it. So all kinds of things can happen.
So one of your projects happens to be up in Alaska, and you're trying to take this radio station and update their systems as well, but also try to convert them to clean wind and solar. So tell us a little bit about that.
That's it, exactly. Yeah, our station, the station that I'm working with, is called Raven Radio, and it's in Sitka, Alaska. And that is a booming metropolis of 8,000 people in Sitka, Alaska. But in the 1980s, when that station started, they realized there were also a lot of people in some indigenous villages nearby and also some fishing villages where there was no radio coverage at all. So they built a network of repeaters that in these smaller towns of like 80 people, 50 people, 100 people, 500 people. And so they have 7 repeaters. And like a lot of things, you know, just like it got put on and it worked. And it worked for a long time. And those places are really hard to get to. You can only get there on a boat or a seaplane. There are no roads that go to any of them. There's no road that goes to Sitka. There are roads inside of Sitka, but you can't drive on the road from Sitka to any other city because it's on an island. And the same with all these outlying communities. So they were very hard to maintain. And so a lot of them have just been kind of running with, you know, someone checking them out every year or two, but no major renovations. So the station decided it was time to do an update of everything so that they could be reached by internet. They could be troubleshot when things gone wrong. I would say right now, like out of the 7 repeaters at any given time, like 4 or so are working. And it's too bad because it's a real, it's a lifeline to those communities. So anyway, what we're doing is while we're replacing the transmitters, we're replacing the antennas. And while we're at it, one of the biggest issues in Alaska is energy. It's ironic because so much oil and gas is mined there, or is drilled for. But in fact, all the oil that comes from Alaska has to go down to Seattle to get refined and then shipped by boat back up. So gas is $10 a gallon there. And a lot of these villages, they only get one diesel shipment per year. And so it's, they're very conscious of like every watt that they use. So we decided that for our installations, we would, to whatever extent we could, we would add wind power and solar panel and also large batteries. That's a real big part of it is for a long time, batteries have been very expensive, difficult to maintain. But in the past couple of years, as a result of electric cars and some serious industrial policy in China and some other things, lithium batteries, which are just so far superior, are becoming not cheap, but possible, you know?
Yeah.
I think we spent $7,000 on a battery bank that probably like 20 years ago would have been much less good and probably would have been $30,000 or $40,000. So we're adding a lot of capacity to be more reliable and to use less diesel.
Pete, you've honed a lot of skills over the years. So I'd like to take a quick look back from your founding of the Radio Mutiny and Prometheus to what you saw as the perils and promises back then and what you've seen today and into the future.
Sure. I mean, I think when I first was involved in a pirate radio station, we were activists that were involved in different movements and we felt that our voices were always stifled. You know, there would be
Philadelphia.
Yeah. We, you know, there'd be 100 or 1,000 of us on a street corner, and then we couldn't even get into a newspaper with, you know, a protest against war or something like that. And so we started a pirate station, and, you know, that kind of undermined the control that corporations had over what people had. Over the ensuing time, that hasn't gone away, but there's become a second challenge. And that second challenge is one way of shutting down free speech is to control the channel and not let anything through. The other way of shutting down free speech today is to flood the attention to put disinformation, false information, nonsense, and confuse people or make people despair. And I think that, that's a new challenge for community media is to figure out like how to like make content that is good, that holds people's attention, that truly informs. And we have the added challenge of a giant industry that's based on just distracting everybody to death. It's only gotten more complicated since I started, not less.
So going back to Alaska, some of these cities, this radio is important to their community. This is how they get their news, right?
It is. Yeah. There's internet is very hard to come by. And in fact, in Alaska, if you use more than a certain number of gigabytes, your internet goes off for until the end of the billing cycle.
Whoa.
So there's a story about a town hall that like some kids got in and watched some YouTube video, and the whole city government had no internet for the next like 6 days. just because like some kids got in and watched YouTube for like an hour. So that's a big challenge there. So internet's not available, and so people use radio a lot.
So what are some difficulties that you're facing in updating these translators, changing the power sources to solar and wind?
Everything about the logistics there is tough. Like the towns you can't get to unless you go on a seaplane or a very slow boat. And shipping things up there is difficult. Everything costs twice as much up there.
Getting around.
Yeah. On the other hand, I had an amazing month last summer where I never took a cell phone out of my pocket because there's no cell coverage. Oh, I couldn't tell time because I don't have a watch and I stopped carrying around my cell phone. I never used keys. I never used money because there's no store in town. I just had to bring all the food I was going to eat. So it was a great vacation from the, modern life. Although I spent the whole time installing solar panels and trying to connect up internet links and, all that sort of thing. So it's a blessing and a curse,
At the same time, yes.
It's great to get away from the internet until someone's trying to contact you to tell you that your shipment of panels is on the way.
Right, yeah. So within the last 30 seconds, is there anything else you'd like to say or anything we didn't ask you that you think is important?
Just so happen to see Hudson Mohawk alive and thriving. You've got a really unique volunteer-driven news model. I've seen very few like this around the country, and I think you're way ahead of the curve in terms of of what you're making here.
Well, thank you for joining us, Petri Dis, and talking about your very important work about keeping radio stations going.
Always great to be here.
Thanks. You, Pete. For our next segment, we hear from Annie Sabinski, who shares her wealth of knowledge in all things asparagus. From growing to cooking and preserving, Annie provides some great tips to help you make the most out of this delicious perennial vegetable. So, if you're a fan of asparagus like me, you want to learn more about this nutritious and friendly, flavorful vegetable.
My name's Annie Skabinski. I'm a Master Gardener volunteer and happy to be part of the Nature Calls podcast team. On today's episode of Patch to Plate, I'm talking about the spring thing we call asparagus. Other early arrivals to our veggie season make me happy. Ramps, fiddlehead ferns, rhubarb, and spinach. These all begin to show up in gardens where we forage, farm stores and stands, and sometimes, though rarely, at a pick-your-own location. I'd like to talk about each of those, but today I just find myself with a lot to say about asparagus. Have you seen it grown? A big field of asparagus looks like something lunar or otherworldly. It's a brown field that looks like somebody ran through and shot a quiver of pencils into the air and they all landed tips up. It's fun to pick asparagus in a field like that. You grab your bucket and you head out. You find some asparagus stalk that looks tasty. Just bend down, bend the stalk, and it'll snap off. Where it snaps will leave the tender vegetable in your hand and the woody stalk still on the ground. The thickness of the stalks you see and pick are going to vary, and they're not indicative of either the age or the tenderness. Thickness of asparagus you enjoy is really a personal preference. Us, we like the thin asparagus. That's our preference. But if it's thicker or thick, it's a good idea to peel it with a vegetable peeler. Good varieties to consider if you want to grow your own: Jersey Giant, Jersey King, Jersey Knight, notice a trend, Viking, KB3, Purple Passion. Check out the attributes of each of these varieties from a link on our Cornell Cooperative Extension page. Like most perennials, it takes a while to establish an asparagus bed, but once you do, it will be productive for years. Asparagus pairs extremely well with butter, cheese, lemon, olive oil, salt and pepper, and eggs. For cheese, particularly Parmesan and Pecorino are favorites, but feta, fontina, goat, Munster, regatta, Romano all work really, really well. For lemon, both the juice and the zest flavor asparagus nicely. keep in mind that asparagus likes to keep company with milk and cream and dill, mushrooms, parsley, shallots, and hearty stocks, vegetable or chicken stock, work well. Vinaigrettes and vinegars are a good pairing with asparagus. So with that in mind, let's get cooking. Thin asparagus cooks faster. Thicker asparagus takes a little longer. If it's thin, like pencil thin or pinky thin, it'll cook really quickly no matter what method you use. If it's any thicker than my index finger, I tend to peel it. You can blanch it, steam it, you can grill it. If you grill it, I recommend you grill it on a screen so it doesn't fall through the grill slats. You can oven roast it and certainly stir fry it. One of my favorite ways to eat asparagus, and we have eaten it in dozens and dozens of ways, is also the simplest. I get a large cast iron skillet hot. I don't use any oil in the pan, I just get the pan hot. And while it's heating, I snap off the ends of asparagus, spray it with a little olive oil, sprinkle it with salt and pepper, and place it in the hot pan. Once it's in the pan, I turn it, I jiggle it, I keep it moving around until the green darkens and the stalks are lightly brown in a few spots. I remove it from the pan and serve. The whole thing just takes a very, very few minutes. Out of the pan, I squeeze a little lemon on it and enjoy it. It's tender. In fact, if you think back to the flavors that asparagus favors, some quick finishes to keep in mind are, once it comes out of the pan, you can drizzle it with extra virgin olive oil, butter, flavored oil, lemon juice, vinaigrette, hollandaise sauce. You can even grate a little hard-boiled egg on it or some Parmesan cheese. If you want to roast the asparagus, we've included a link to a recipe. But basically, preheat the oven, hot, 425 Fahrenheit, snap off the ends of the asparagus, and place the tender stalks on a foil-lined baking sheet. You can spray them with a little olive oil or cooking oil. Sprinkle them with salt and pepper, some minced garlic, and some grated Parmesan. I use my hands to rub that mix onto the vegetables so that they're evenly coated. And then I roast them for about 8 minutes, depending on the thickness. Again, out of the oven and serve them immediately. Another good way to oven prep your asparagus is, again, hot oven, 425 convection or 450 bake. Snap off the wooded ends, get them in a rimmed baking sheet. Sprinkle with olive oil and a little salt, and then pour half a cup or so of chicken stock, or the vegetarian version of that, over the asparagus. Sprinkle on some crumbled feta and toss some halved cherry tomatoes in with the asparagus, and pop that in the oven for 5 to 8 minutes until the asparagus is tender and the cheese is just starting to soften and melt. A nice quick salad starts with cutting the asparagus into bite-sized pieces and blanching in salted water. Do it for a minute or two and then transfer the pieces to an ice bath. You always want to do that to stop the cooking from your veggies. Transfer them to an ice bath. While it's cooking or cooling, whisk together some oils and vinegars and a little soy sauce. Toss the cooled asparagus in the vinaigrette and sprinkle with sesame seeds just before service, or if you prefer, pass around a bowl of sesame seeds and let people sprinkle at the table. Any of the preparations that we talk about are relatively simple. This is a delicious, very, very seasonal vegetable in our area. And to savor it plainly with the flavors that merely enhance it are the best way to do it justice. I mentioned earlier that asparagus loves eggs and cheese. When I think about that combination, I think most frequently about putting together a quiche or a frittata. But let's talk quiche. We usually make our quiche without a crust, but certainly it's easy to make a crust for a quiche. You can either buy one in the refrigerator case at the store or make a simple pastry crust. Without a crust, we typically like to serve it with a nice piece of toasted sourdough bread. But to get started, preheat your oven to 400 degrees Fahrenheit and spray a pie plate or a quiche pan with cooking spray. Snap the woody ends off your asparagus and cut into 1-inch or thumb-sized pieces. Cuts on the angle are very attractive. Also chop a tablespoon or more of dill. Spray a large frying pan with pan spray or melt a little butter, a little, a teaspoon or two. When the pan and butter slash oil are hot, add the asparagus and sauté for 2 or 3 minutes. You're not cooking it through. You're merely getting it started to finish cooking in the oven. Add the dill and sauté another minute or so until the herbs are wilted. Take the pan off the heat. In a separate large bowl, whisk together half a dozen eggs, a half a cup of dairy. Whatever you have on hand is fine. If you use whole milk, 2%, skim, it'll work. The higher the dairy fat content, the creamier the outcome will be. But use what you have on hand and use what your family likes to eat. So you've whisked in the dairy. Add a good pinch of salt, a couple of teaspoons of mustard, and whisk until those items are thoroughly combined. Then fold in the asparagus, a cup of your grated cheese of choice, and pour the mixture into your pan. Bake for 20 minutes-ish. The quiche should be set at that point. A butter knife inserted in the center. Make them out shiny wet, but it shouldn't be dripping liquid. It's also fine to pop it back in for a few minutes to brown the surface, because brown food tastes good. This is a great brunch dish. I like to have it ready, sitting on a baking sheet, oven preheated, when my guests arrive. I can greet them, pop the quiche into the oven, pour drinks, get everybody in the kitchen to help assemble a salad, and by the time the quiche is ready, the salad will be done and the conversation's already well underway. You can make a quiche like this more substantial, actually into a meal, by adding diced smoked salmon or lightly sautéed shrimp or maybe some thinly sliced and sautéed morel mushrooms. Add them to the egg and dairy when you add the asparagus. If I added smoked salmon or shrimp, I'd probably stick with dill as my herb. If I add morels, I think I'd swap out the dill for thyme and its woodier flavor profile to tie the asparagus to the mushrooms. I've included a link to basic crustless quiche in the show notes, but play around, make it your own. I like to make a quiche like this and serve it warm for dinner. Leftovers are good for breakfast and great for a lunchbox lunch. Remember, the season for asparagus is short, very short, so I've included some links to freezing, canning, and pickling the asparagus to help you extend the season. For more on food preservation, listen to episode 6 and check out the CCE food preservation page. For other recipes, please go to the nutrition page on our Cornell website. Enjoy! That's it for this edition of From Patch to Plate. I'm Annie Skibinski.
And for more fun food segments, head to our website, mediasanctuary.org. This is also from WGXC, so you can also go check them out as well.
For our final segment, we replay one of Tom France's Talking with Poets, where he speaks with Mary Panza, a mainstay on the Albany poetry scene since 1988.
According to her own bio, Mary Panza has been a mainstay on the Albany poetry scene since 1988. She's been witness to countless open mics, naked poets, fires, drunks, chapbooks, career changes, organizations, both coming and going, festivals, and great poetry and spoken word. Mary hosted 2 long-running open mics, 5 years at Borders in the late 90s, and Poets Speak Loud at Lark Tavern and then McGeary's for 15 years until the pandemic hit in 2020. Last December, Mary read her poem, We're Barefoot People, at the first Year in Review spoken word event at the Linda.
She asked me how to walk in high heels. We don't, I told her. We are barefoot people. The summer I was 13 is a blur to me now. I had mono and can remember going to sleep in early July, waking up for some orange juice and going back to sleep till the middle of August. I can remember for being tired for weeks, but wanting to go outside and show off my 30-pound weight loss to the kids on my block. Hindsight being 20/20, I should have stayed on the couch with my mother close by. We should have watched what Erica Kane was up to on that particular day. We should have talked about what was really happening around us. Mom and I should have had an exit strategy that didn't involve Valium or Carlo Rossi. We should have done a lot of things we didn't do. He was sick of me being sick. He thought it was a ploy to get out of having a job. The man who called my called himself my father was a bastard. He comes to me in the form of saltines and milk. It was a Depression-era dessert. My daughter loves saltines. She tells me they're pretty good with milk. I spit between my index and middle finger. It's a gesture taught to me by a book. He may be blind to her in hell, but he still manages to get a dig in at me. He was a bastard. My daughter is outside in the summer. She swims and plays and has as much fun as a 13-year-old thinks is cool. She plays tennis. She is tall and smart and proud. I pray she never has to fall asleep to escape, only to wake up and still be tired. We don't wear high heels. We are barefoot people.
I had mono when I was 13. And it kind of, during COVID, it just kind of reminded me of that, like, that summer where I couldn't go anywhere and I don't remember much of it. You know, all these memories kept coming back of, like, I remember waking up, like, in July to get a glass of orange juice and just going back to bed. And during the day, I would lay on the couch and my mother would sit in her chair and we'd watch soap operas. And I would have to, like, get into my bed before my father got home because he was convinced I was faking it so I didn't have to get a summer job. No, I was 13 and I had already been working since I was 10 or 11 babysitting. And I mean, I had mono, you know, it was clear. I went to the doctor. I was on antibiotics. He wasn't a good person and he didn't want me. And it just, all of that kind of, because I came so much later in their lives, he just didn't want me. He didn't want to start over. He didn't want a family. He certainly didn't want a girl. I don't know that my life would have been easier had I been born a boy. I don't think so, because my brother had it pretty tough with him. I think he was done. And that's kind of what it's about. And when, during the summers, we would, you know, because I was on 4th Street in South Troy, between Madison and the canal, we just walk around barefoot. Like, we were all, you know, the neighbors and all the kids my age, we'd run around barefoot. And, you know, that summer, I really couldn't be barefoot.
I asked Mary when she started telling stories and putting pen to paper.
When I was little, Nana Panza lived with us for a short amount of time. We'd play hide and seek and Nana wouldn't look for me. And it was usually, you know, she was smarter than anyone gave her credit for. And it was usually during The Edge of Night, which was her soap opera. So when I was little, I used to draw stick people soap operas. To this day, I still watch Young and the Restless. I mean, I grew up on stories, if you will. And so I would draw these little stick figures in these little scenarios, nothing dirty. I was a kid. But then I could change the story. And it was really just between me and myself. And I would draw these pictures and then I would put them in a certain order. And then if it was a different day and it was a different story, I'd move the order. So, yeah. I didn't really start writing poetry till I was much older.
After writing poetry for a while, Mary decided to share her work at a local open mic. But back in 1988, there was only one game in town, the legendary QE2 open mic hosted by Tom Nuttall.
I got up to the mic and there was feedback. And Tom Nuttall adjusted the mic and I just said, look, if you don't want me up here, then say so. And everyone started laughing. And when I heard them laugh, I'm like, oh, they get it. These are my people. This was at the QE2 and it was summer of 1988. I mean, I can remember everybody distinctly. Then afterwards I got applause and I loved that. And it just made me feel valued and that somebody heard what I was saying. Although it was drivel and nonsense, people heard it. I guess to me at that time, it wasn't drivel and nonsense.
Why did you keep coming back?
I just liked how, this is going to sound crazy, me saying this about the QE2, but I liked the way it smelled. It was raw and it was dirty and there was no pretense behind it. And you didn't really have to behave and you could say what you want. And, you know, I felt like I found a home. And I was young and had to prove myself. I mean, there were people at those open mics getting master's degree and doctrines and, you know, way more educated than I ever planned on being.
A theme that runs through most of Mary's poetry is empowerment, standing up for yourself as a woman and a mother. So I asked Mary if she considers herself a feminist poet.
And I was always under the impression that feminism was you had the freedom to choose and you could choose whatever. And I would never tell another woman you're doing it wrong. You need to choose for yourself. And that's what feminism should be. Should be like you have the breathing room. Not that I wanted to like run out and have kids, because that, you know, wasn't in my plan till it happened. But it was just, I don't believe in putting somebody else down for their life choices.
Right.
And that's what I felt like it was. And that there wasn't, that wasn't who I've never been one to really judge how another person lives their life and makes them happy. As long as you're not hurting anybody, I really don't care.
She was well on her way to living the rest of her life as a party girl when, at age 37, the party really began and she became a mother. How did that affect her writing?
I don't talk about, like, sex or men as much. Protective over Julia and her privacy. And, you know, that's why I haven't really even written a lot about my blog, because right now I'm so engrossed in her life. You know, she's 16. We're trying to get ready for college and stuff like that. So most of the stories I have to tell involve her. And I haven't told them because she's still young and she's got the right to that privacy. And for me to tell a story about my experience with her interferes with her privacy. So the original question is, how has my writing changed? I think I'm a little more protective and I'm telling my backstory more, because for years I didn't. It just wasn't anybody's business and I wasn't ready to do it. After 150 years of therapy, I can talk about these things and not have a nervous breakdown.
Mary Panza is currently vice president of the Hudson Valley Writers Guild, and she'll be hosting the 2022 edition of the Year in Review event at the Linda on Central Avenue in Albany on Saturday, December 17th. For Hudson Mohawk Magazine, I'm Tom Francis.
Check the Talking with Poets segment every Tuesday night or Wednesday morning, or check websites mediasanctuary.org for past episodes of Talking with Poets. And that's our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Kalen McPherson.
And I'm David Moore. Our engineer is Kalen McPherson. We thank all of our volunteers who made today's episode possible. Headlines from Mark Dunley. Segment producers Mark Dunley, Moses Nagel, Annie Sapiensky of WGXC, Tom Francis, and your co-hosts, Kalen and me, David Moore. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
We want to hear from you. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, Media Sanctuary, or send us an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Tune in weekdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. To hear full episodes and individual stories are available on demand on our website and on your favorite podcast platform. We appreciate you listening. And remember, radio isn't dying, but growing into the far, far future. Until next time.